The issues that matter most, right here. The Drew Mariani Show
on Relevant Radio.
Well, the Indian variant is spreading throughout the world. It's causing a significant outbreak in Russia right now, showing that the Russian vaccine doesn't have very good cross protection. And it's causing 6% of the new infections here in the United States and doubling every week.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
That, of course, the great Dr. Robert Tabali. I always enjoy him, his perspective. He was on last Friday's show. And we're taking a look at the Delta variant. In fact, we'll talk a little bit more about it coming up. If you missed it, again, it was hour one of Friday's broadcast. You can learn more about that. Now, look, I would encourage you to this. Go back to our podcast. There's such a wealth of information. Whether you're listening early in the morning to Morning Air or Patrick, or you want to listen again to this broadcast or any of the shows, there's just a tremendous wealth of conversation and insight, and I think you'll find great value in it. It's kind of a school of catechesis, if you will, and it's free. That's the beauty of it, right? You can listen to it as long as you want. You can revisit it. You can share it with someone else. So lots of great conversation out there. We've got a lot to get into today. We're going to pray the chaplet at the top of the next hour. Got a couple intentions that have come in we're asking your prayers for. And, of course, I hope you'll join me. If you have a loved one that needs prayer, or you do, or you're in a tough situation, join this army. Join this incredibly large spiritual family for prayer. And we'll get into that and a whole lot more. Speaking of the Delta coronavirus, so let's hit on that for a moment. The Delta is a variation of COVID-19. It was known as the Indian virus. India virus. Now, we're getting these names, these Greek names like Delta. Health officials, they're worried about it. They're saying that it could become the dominant strain within weeks. And yesterday, I told you it accounted for about 12% of all new cases. Well, I have another number for you. According to NPR News, I happened to see this. It flew across my radar, and I always want to bring you the most up-to-date and pertinent information. They're now saying it's not 12%. It's 14%. Of all new cases. And experts that they interviewed, they're saying that the variant could cause an upsurge in cases later this summer or as fall begins, especially, they claim, among the non-vaccinated. And I'm really, this is something, I almost don't want to tell you this, but I'll share it with you anyway. I probably shouldn't. I'm in one of those moods today. I have a friend. And we are acquaintances of a woman, and I have to keep her confidential, who's a mystic. I mean, she has visions, apparitions of the Mother of God. She suffers the stigmata. She has competent spiritual direction. The bishop is aware of her situation. When COVID-19 was spreading, and it looked like the vaccination was coming out, everything was going to be fine, a friend of mine said to me, he says, I spoke to her, and I won't give her a name, and she says, just as you think that it looks like this is being resolved, there are going to be new strains and new variants and new problems. And, she was so right in this. So as everybody was saying, oh, we got Pfizer, we've got AstraZeneca, we got J&J, they went through this litany of different vaccines they had as the cure-all, I sat back and I said, well, we'll see whether or not she's accurate and true to her prophecy. True to her vision, true to the knowledge that she was given, we're seeing this. And I just wonder what looms in your future, in the end of the summer, or perhaps even in the, the fall when things really break out. Because the reason I say that, the Massachusetts Department of Public Health, they reported that they found almost 4,000 people who had been vaccinated, right? Almost 4,000, 3,800. Who had been vaccinated, they were infected with COVID-19 anyway. About 1 in 1,000 people have been fully vaccinated. The Epoch Times the reported that the CDC, the Center for Disease Control and Prevention, says that breakthrough cases like that they're expected, and other experts have said that the symptoms that these people have experienced, they've been mild, they've been for a brief duration, but still we're seeing people get COVID-19. I just wonder what new variants we might see, how long we are going to have to persist with COVID-19. And as I said, we're seeing nature cry out. I think we're seeing this particular situation as well. A friend of mine called. I had a conversation with him. I was going to Mass earlier today. And he just says, Drew, he says, I just think of the times in Noah, right? He says, the people frolicked. They lived in their sinful ways. They were totally ignorant of what loomed in their future, right? Noah was building this ark, and they probably mocked and laughed at this crazy man building this great structure until the rain fell, and the rain continued to fall, and the torrents came, and the water rose. And they still laughed when it was up to their knees, but when it got to their waist and to their chest and to their chin, suddenly a different attitude. I just wonder where we are right now when the Mother of God has been sent by heaven to every habitable continent to warn the human race to amend their lives to return to God. When we see the rejection of God in so many ways, not just from the high office in this land, but in our own families. I mean, think about that. I mean, look at how people are living today. And yet God in his love and mercy is constantly reaching out. So I think some of these events that we see, they're wake-up calls to realize that we're not in control of life. We are not in control. God is the ultimate master of all things, and he loves us infinitely. He's a tender and loving father. These sometimes are ways of getting our attention. That's my personal take, and I'm not representing that for anybody else. But I do sit back, and I think it's a time for me to do more penance, to pray more, to get to confession more frequently, to grow in my own holiness, so that when that rain does begin to fall, I can clearly see what's unfolding around me. But let me tell you what's going on right now. It's not just this Delta virus, Delta variant. There's lots of other variants that are out there. But Moscow, I'll tell you what's happening in Moscow. CNN did a report on how the Delta variant is impacting Russia. So check this out. Listen to this.
Aggressive and infectious. That's the way Moscow's mayor describes a coronavirus variant spreading through the city. Health officials in Moscow reported more than 9,000 new COVID-19 cases on Friday, the highest daily figure for the city since the pandemic began. That from the city's mayor, who says the Delta variant, first identified in India, is responsible for nearly 90% of new infections.
The situation in Moscow with the spread of COVID-19 disease is rapidly deteriorating, and the dynamics are quite unexpected, since more than 60% of Muscovites have either been ill or vaccinated.
The WHO says Moscow is just one of several places where the Delta variant is thriving. And with so many people across the world still unvaccinated, there's plenty of opportunity for it to circulate even more.
The Delta variant is well on its way to becoming the dominant variant globally because of its significantly increased transmissibility.
One WHO official says Africa is particularly vulnerable because of a lack of vaccines. The Delta variant has been detected in at least 14 countries on the continent. But even countries that have had success with their vaccination programs are being inundated with new cases. More than 46% of the population in the UK is fully vaccinated, but COVID-19 infections are increasing there once again, the Delta variant fueling the rise.
I personally think we're going to see more of it. That's my take. I hope I'm wrong. Novavax, a new vaccine, is on the on the horizon right now, too. You might want to look into that. As I said, if we spoke to Dr. Dabali last Friday about that, I think you'll find that very interesting. I pray to God this is diminished and behind us. I'm delighted we don't have to wear masks anymore, and I'm delighted to see cases diminishing. We're not seeing the deaths that we did before. But, I don't want to underestimate this. A lot of people are saying, well, I'm vaccinated. Can I still get COVID? That's a great question. NBC 10 in Boston looked. It was now a very common question.
And just because we've reached this important occasion now in the Commonwealth, it doesn't mean that we're now all of a sudden the pandemic is over.
The CDC says out of more than 84 million who have been fully vaccinated across the U.S., less than 6,000 ended up getting the virus still, which amounts to about 0.007%. And while the director of the CDC says that number has likely been underestimated, it still shows that the vaccines are working. Dr. Kimi Kobayashi at UMass Memorial says it's also important to remember you aren't considered fully vaccinated until it's been 14 days since your second dose of the vaccine. He also says it's not clear yet if those who are vaccinated can still transmit the virus.
Yeah, so look, we'll stay on it. I've been following this for you for a year and a half practically now. It's been a long time, hasn't it? It's been a long, long time. But, you know, I had the opportunity to go on pilgrimage recently, and airports are full. I remember traveling during the pandemic at one point, and it was like a morgue. Nobody was around. But with the pandemic now coming to the end, summer here, people are getting out to travel, and that means airlines, they're beginning to pick up a lot more business, more than they've had in a long time. But there's one problem, right? They don't have the staffing to meet the demand. And I was struck by this. We're having a truck driver shortage. So if you're looking for a new career, maybe you're retired, maybe you're thinking, hey, I want out of this. I'd love to see the country. Well, look at the trucking. We have a truck driver shortage, but we also have a pilot shortage. So when the shutdown hit, pilots, you know, had no one to take anyone anywhere, and they were furloughed, or many of them were actually offered early retirement packages, and they took them. And others went, you know, to the trucking industry or went on food stamps. And because of that, airlines, rather than increasing the number of flights, they're cutting routes and they're raising prices, which is kind of surprising. You could have flown anywhere for peanuts, you know, 6 months ago. Today, you're going to find, in fact, I had a couple flights that I had booked that they actually canceled on me, and I had to get different flights. You know, I guess there wasn't enough people on them, or they wanted to cut that route. I don't know. Bottom line is the rates are going up, and there's going to be less flights. So if you're planning on going somewhere, you might want to book now. How long they're going to be able to do that before they start losing business again, I don't know. The Biden administration, one other bit of news here. I think this will be good news for some. I have some concerns. The Biden administration's made it possible for people who can claim the child tax credit to get it paid to them in advance of their taxes in monthly installments. And that's not a bad thing. I think it could be a good thing. In fact, the IRS is just starting to send out those payments starting next month. But that's not the end of it. In fact, the president said yesterday he wants to make this permanent. Here's what President Biden said when he announced the child tax credit. I think it was a month or two ago.
All middle-class, working-class families will get this tax cut. It's a one-year cut that reduces your taxes by $3,000 a year for each child you have under the age of 18. Two kids, it's a $6,000 tax cut. And if those kids are under the age of six, they'll actually get $3,600 per child. Here's the great news. You won't have to wait until your next year's tax return to get that break. I'm announcing today that on July 15th and the 15th of every month thereafter throughout the year, you will get deposited in your bank account half of your tax cut, at least $250 per child each month, a direct deposit into your account. So if you're a working family with two kids, you're going to get $500 a month into your bank account on the 15th of every month starting July. We're getting a tax cut this year now when you need it and not have to wait. And if you get your tax cut refund deposited in your bank account automatically, this tax cut will be put into your account automatically. If not, it will be mailed to you. In addition to helping Americans hard-pressed and working families, experts have told us this will cut child poverty in America in half. This tax cut sends a clear and powerful message to American working families with children. Help is here.
All right. That was the president a couple, I think it was last month or the month before that. It was a little while ago, just breaking it all down. The child tax credit, which was in the American Rescue Plan, offers $3,000 for every child 6 to 17, $3,600 if you have a child under six. Of course, you need to be an eligible family. But the income thresholds to receive the full credit is $75,000 for a single filer. If you file, you know, a joint tax return, it's $150,000. So there you go. You may see in now just a matter of weeks that money automatically coming into your bank account. So people who get it, you know, they're going to be getting these monthly payments of $250 to $300. And look, the American Rescue Plan, it makes this a temporary thing. It's supposed to be temporary. But Biden says that his American Families Plan, he wants to make it a permanent feature. So you might see this, well into the future. So put that on your on your radar. Hey, one quick weird story here, and then I want to bring you up to onto an important piece of political news. Diamonds. Do you like diamonds? Yeah, I think a lot of girls do, right? They just found one of the third largest diamonds ever mined. This diamond came in at 1,098 carats. 1,098 carats, almost 1,100 carats. That's a big rock, you know? It's a huge rock. They found it in Botswana, and diamond miners came across this massive stone. It comes in behind the 3,106-carat Cullinan stone that was recovered in South Africa back in 1905. And then there was another one that just beat this out by a few carats, 1,109, dug up in Botswana back in 2015. So pretty cool stuff. And also, if I have a chance, I'll tell you about this giant rhinoceros that they found. Researchers in China have discovered a massive file, a fossil. And it appears to be the biggest mammal ever discovered in history, right? It's clocking in at 26 feet in length, 16 feet high, 24 tons in weight. Could you imagine? Look, I'm 6 foot and some change, right? 16 feet high? I mean, I can walk under that thing a few times. I mean, think about the length of it. This is a rhino. Amazing how massive these creatures were, just absolutely massive. If I have time, I'll fill you in more, but I want to get to one final story here before I run out of time. And that deals with the federal government, well, it deals with Capitol Hill. The U.S. Senate of course, the Senate's been called the greatest deliberative body in the world, but part of that has to do with the rule that is unique to the Senate. And that's called the filibuster, and that's in trouble right now. It's a rule that allows a bill to be discussed until a three-fifths majority of the Senate, that's currently 60 senators, vote to end debate on a topic. And that vote is known as voting to end cloture. But it's a rule that forces the senators to try to reach consensus on whatever the bill is about. Let me give you a little background. Here's a little history, because there's talk of doing away with it. Let me just give you the background. King 5, 11 News, 11 Alive News reported on this. So did the AP, and they'll explain the history of the filibuster. Listen.
If you can't beat them, talk them to death. That's the basic idea behind the filibuster. Whether it's Senator Strom Thurmond's 24-hour and 18-minute speech in 1957 or Senator Ted Cruz reading Dr. Seuss during his 21-hour talk in 2013.
I do not like green eggs and ham.
The filibuster is an interesting and controversial part of our political process. Let's look at why it exists. In 1806, senators eliminated part of the process to end debate and move toward a vote on a proposed bill.
And they didn't realize what they had done at first.
What they'd done, totally by accident, was eliminate any formal means of ending debate on a bill. Senators realized they could delay a vote on legislation they didn't like by talking, sometimes endlessly. Typically, senators from one party are outnumbered by the other. The filibuster is an often effective way for the minority party to delay a vote they're unlikely to win. Kennesaw State political science professor Kerwin Swint tells us at one time the filibuster would tie up all Senate business. Now it impacts only the bill that is the subject of a long-winded delay.
It became very common, a way to try and get concessions from the majority party, a way to negotiate and get favorable terms.
In 1917, senators passed what's known as Rule 22. If 60 out of 100 senators can agree, they can end a filibuster in most cases. It's not easy.
You could talk about whatever you wanted to. The floor was yours.
And that's how Dr. Seuss became part of the American political process.
Yeah, that's a classic, isn't it? So for the last 15 years or so, the rule has come under a lot of pressure. Both parties know that it limits their ability to get their agenda through the Senate. So most recently, we saw the filibuster for judicial nominees come to an end that brought about the nomination of Brett Kavanaugh and Neil Gorsuch and Amy Coney Barrett, all of whom were, you know, vehemently, strongly opposed by Democrats. Now Democrats want to end the use of the filibuster altogether. Yeah, all of a sudden it's a relic of the Jim Crow eras. But there are only two problems that Democrats are facing. Two members of their own party, Joe Manchin of West Virginia and Kyrsten Sinema of Arizona, both have made it very clear they have no intention of voting to get rid of the filibuster. And Sinema wrote a column today in the Washington Post saying that if you eliminate that rule, then there's going to be large swings back and forth, you know, between laws. A law passed by a closely divided Senate with a Democrat majority today can easily be overturned in 2 years by the Senate majority when it switches parties. But the media aren't letting up on her or on Manchin, and they're continuing to pressure him. You know, they're pressuring them on Senate Bill 1, which would federalize elections and get votes tomorrow, you know, to get on the vote issue tomorrow. But look, it won't get passed unless the filibuster is removed. And there are a couple compromises, compromise bills on that very issue that are out that conservatives are dead set against. And, you know, they won't have any possibility of passing unless these filibusters go away. So what's interesting to note is that the Washington Post has shown some archived audio from senators like Senator Sanders, Senator Chuck Schumer, who opposed previously changing the filibuster, but apparently they want it now. Here's their change of position. Listen to this.
Let us go no further down this road. I hope the Republican leader and I can, in the coming months, find a way to build a firewall around the legislative filibuster, which is the most important distinction between the Senate and the House.
When you were in the minority, you joined plenty of efforts to filibuster legislation.
The big difference is that we were always willing to negotiate in a bipartisan way. Mitch McConnell isn't.
Why would you not think this is the beginning of the end for the filibuster?
We cannot fail on key things to our democracy like S1, and everything's on the table.
No, I'm not crazy about getting rid of the filibuster.
At the end of the day, we have to end the filibuster. It is just unfair and undemocratic for a minority of the Senate to prevent what the majority of people want in this country, in the House, and in the Senate.
Everybody I've talked to believe that the legislative filibuster should stay there, and I will personally resist efforts to get rid of it.
I think the filibuster is going to be a defining debate for our party, whether we want to start delivering real results. We need to deliver on the demands, not of Democrats, but of Americans who want to see their government function.
I strongly oppose the filibuster, especially the abuse of the filibuster. It's not so much the use, it's really the abuse that was the trademark of Republicans in the last session. We're still in that session. But I would use, as Senator Murphy just said, every tool at our disposal. The rules are the rules.
I've stated repeatedly, literally for 10 years that I've been in the United States Senate, that I advocate abolishing the filibuster or drastically reforming it.
I'm committed to never voting to change the legislative filibuster. I'm not ready to get rid of the filibuster yet. But frankly, Joy, we have to make progress, and we have to deliver on the results the American people are looking for.
So funny how attitudes and statements change with time and with agenda. When we come back, I have to take a short pause here. I want to fill you in on the IRS. There's talk of them, of some wanting to strip the Catholic Church of its nonprofit status. We'll take a look at religious liberty in this country and so much more. We got a lot straight ahead. Stay with me. I'll be right back. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
Religious freedom is indeed a universal human right that I will fight for, one that our team at the department will continue to fight for.
It's the Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Great to be with you today. Thanks for joining us. There is a new case that you're going to be hearing about. So let me get you up to speed a little bit early. There's a new evangelical group. They're called Christians Engaged. All right, Christians Engaged. It was started in order to get Christians engaged in the political world. I think it's a great idea, right? If we want to transform the culture, if we want to bring things back to a more God-centered focus, then we need to be active in the culture. We need to go out into the public square and be witnesses for Christ. You know, at the very least, what they want is Christians to get registered to vote and then get out there and actually vote. Because, and here's a problem I have. I look at the Catholic vote in particular. The Catholic vote, it's not a Catholic vote. You know, it's terrible the way sometimes Catholics vote. I look at it, how they broke for Hillary Clinton, the way they broke for Joe Biden, things along those lines. And look, I'm not being partisan here. I'm not waving a particular flag. I'd say the same thing. I look at the policies that are so anti-Catholic that certain politicians hold. And then I look at how Catholics get behind and support them, and I'm thinking, how in good conscience can you advance the culture of death or work towards redefining marriage or any of these other issues that are diametric to what we believe as Christians and as the way we should conduct and live our lives. But I get the idea. Let's get people out. Let's get them registered. Let's get them out to vote. And let's do our part. Let's inform people. Make sure they understand the issues. And this is a pretty ordinary group in that way, because, you know, there's all kinds of get out and vote groups, right? You've probably been solicited by some of them. Most of them are partisan. Some of them aren't. But when Christians engaged, when they applied to the IRS for their 501c3 status, that's your tax-exempt status, the IRS said, no, denied, right? Denied them. You know what the reason? Now listen to this. Turn up the radio just so you hear this. The reason the IRS denied Christians engaged: Bible teachings are typically, the IRS says, affiliated with Republican Party and candidates. Now, that's a direct quote from the IRS rejection letter. They're affiliated with a particular party and candidates. Really? You know, Christians engaged, they filed a federal lawsuit against them. They're accusing the IRS of playing partisan politics. And the reason for that is because the former first lady, right, Michelle Obama, I don't know if you remember her. She was passionate about this. She started her own Get Out the Vote group, which, of course, is for the Democrat Party. So if it's about partisanship, if it's about candidates, how can Michelle Obama get a 501c3 status? Okay, yeah, you're right. Her husband is what was the president, was former president. Her group got immediate approval from the IRS. On top of that, just to give you another shade here, the Democrat lawmakers who are making threats against the Catholic Church, right? And we talked about this a little bit yesterday. I think this is egregious. When a Democratic lawmaker makes a threat because they don't like the way the Catholic Church is, you know, conducting itself. The bishop, of course, we're discussing the draft of the document on the Eucharist, on Eucharistic coherence. We talked to Bishop Papraki yesterday in hour two of that, right after the chaplain. If you missed it, go to my podcast and check it out. Great conversation on what the bishops are thinking and how it will apply to candidates like Nancy Pelosi and Joe Biden and to you and to me, to the average Catholics. It's not just it's not a political document. It's about, you know, revitalizing the Eucharist. But I don't want to get off tangent here. So, you know, the bishops are talking about this Eucharistic coherence document that they're going to be deliberating on, and then ultimately it's going to come, I think, to fruition in November. The media has been solely focusing on the political aspects of this, just totally, because they don't want President Joe Biden to be denied communion for his pro-abortion stand. That'd be terrible. You can't do that. So some Democratic lawmakers they went on Twitter, and they're threatening. This is the thing that irritated me. They're threatening to remove the tax-exempt status of the Catholic Church in the United States if the bishops, if they go ahead and they deny the president the Eucharist. They said, you know, that would be a political act and it would violate their 501c3 status. I'm like, no, what? Are you kidding me? So, look, this is where we are right now. And I had a conversation with one of my producers this morning. I said, you know, we were talking about Thomas More and John Fisher and how they went to death, you know, to Henry VIII. And today we remember them in a special way. And I said, I'm so glad we don't live in that time. I'm glad we live in the 21st century where, you know, you don't. He says, Drew, I'm a little concerned about what looms in our own future. You know, what kind of persecution you're going to see. And this is part of it. It might even ratchet up to something else. I'm joined today by Professor Robert Destro. He's a professor of law at Columbus School of Law, the Catholic University of America. And it's good to have him with us today. Always good to get his perspective and his expertise on these issues. Professor, I appreciate your time. Welcome back.
Well, thanks for having me.
The IRS and overreach, let's talk about that. I mean, Twitter's Twitter, you know, so I want to take it with a grain of salt, but threatening because you don't like the way the bishops are conducting their meeting to take away their 501c3 status, that's silly. Is the IRS's action an overreach when it comes to this case of Christians engaged? I don't see how they're much different than Michelle Obama.
Well, you know, let me explain one thing real quick first. You know, taking away the tax-exempt status, political parties are exempt from taxes. Michelle Obama, other, you know, League of Women Voters, there's all kinds of organizations that are exempt from taxes. So this is an attempt to control the internal discipline of the church.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. Absolutely. I don't think it's anything more than bluster, do you? I mean, would it ever come to fruition?
Oh, I think they would do it in a nanosecond. That's why they were doing it to the group that you just mentioned. Sorry, I forgot their name.
Yeah, Christians.
But they always pick on the small ones first.
That's true. Christians Engaged. Yeah, you know, and I thought, my gosh, how blatant can you be? You know, and what they said, too.
Well, you know, they were pretty blatant during the Obama administration, holding back C3 status. They're weaponizing the IRS just like they're weaponizing a lot of other agencies. But this is not a big surprise. Yeah. They've been talking about this for a long time.
Yeah, this kind of thing happened during the Obama administration under Lois Lerner, and it never really properly, it was never, I think, properly dealt with. I mean, how is it that they're getting away with this again? You know, is it out of fear? People fear the institution, the agency? There's nobody that can stand up to them? I mean, give me your take on it.
Well, there's a couple of reasons. One, lawsuits against the IRS only take you so far.
Yeah.
Second, there's no, I mean, look, by being as blatant as they were in that letter, that basically is as in your face as you're ever going to get. And so they don't care if they get sued.
Yeah.
I mean, what they want, they're going to go in and they're going to argue that this is perfectly justifiable. And, you know, this is, they're being brazen here, and they want to be. This is an attack.
Yep.
It's not a random occurrence.
Yeah, so can the tax-exempt status of the Catholic Church here in the States actually be removed just like that? I would think this is such a big institution. I mean, you would have to have some serious or egregious violation of it. What are your thoughts on it? I mean, would the tax-exempt status of the Catholic Church ever be in danger?
Well, I mean, without getting into the arcane details of it, it would be pretty hard to do, you know. But remember, what they're doing is they're sending a signal to everybody, you know, basically keep your nose out of no morality in politics, folks. That's verboten. That's the message.
All right.
I mean, the idea that, you know, that only Republicans, you know, pray for people in government is so absurd. I mean, it's hard to describe how stupid it is, but nonetheless, this is what your tax dollars at work.
Yeah, no kidding. Let's take a few calls. If you want to join me, I'm speaking with Professor Robert Destro. You can get in now at 888-914-9149. Professor Paul wants to join the conversation. He's listening in Long Beach, California. Hi, Paul.
Yeah, hi. Actually, I'm not a professor, but thank you.
No, I'm talking about Professor Destro. But it's good to have you, Paul.
Oh, thanks. Hey, listen, I just, the comment about Catholic voting, I want to just mention.
Sure.
There's a danger in generational politics. Yep. I've seen this in my own extended family and immediate family, that there's this identity thing of, if my father was a Democrat and his father before him, and
right,
so on, that it's become such an ingrained in some people that they would almost take the side of the party ahead of the church.
So true.
And unfortunately, that may be one of the reasons, when you look at the 50% you were mentioned, or 60%,
yep,
that seem to vote against the church issues anyway. I see this thing about identity politics where, I just can't. I'm sorry, it's heresy if I vote for a Republican or I vote for somebody else. So I just want to make that comment.
No, I think you're right. It's become almost a religion to some people, handed down from generation to generation. And yeah, I think Paul's observation, Professor, is right on. During the last election, you know, the bishops came out and they said to Catholics in this country, life has to be the preeminent priority. You know, so when you go into the voting booth, evaluate the candidates, you know, evaluate that issue as the top of the pyramid. Of course, there's a lot of other factors that weigh into how you form your conscience and ultimately how you vote, but that's got to be the top of the list. And there are some people who I've heard on the air, and you know, Paul was just mentioning it, who says, I'm a Democrat or I'm a Republican, I would never vote for the other party. It's as if though the party is what's holy and not the principles that they stand for. You know, it's kind of a massive disconnect. Your thoughts on that, your observations?
Well, just remember that Hillary called people deplorables.
Yep.
You know, and that's and she's including, I might add. You know, remember Barack Obama talked about the people who cling to their Bibles and their guns. These are the deplorables as well. What a lot of the people who are voting don't realize that they are included in that group because they really don't do their homework about what these positions are or what the candidates really think.
Yeah, that's so true. That really is. You know, there is there's this amendment, the Johnson Amendment. I'm sure most people probably are aware of it. The Johnson Amendment was named after then Senator Lyndon Johnson. It was passed in 1954 without debate or really without a lot of analysis. And he added it to that year's tax code because there were two, I think, nonprofit organizations in Texas that were successfully opposing his reelection campaign, and he wanted them silenced. And it worked. He won reelection. But in the process, he also silenced every nonprofit organization, every single church in the country on the subject of political campaigns. And we deal with that today. I mean, most of us have been living in that system now for decades. And most people don't even realize that before this amendment was passed, churches and nonprofits, they could talk about anything without restriction. The only exception being that nonprofits could, you know, could not use a substantial portion of their money for lobbying. Your thoughts on the Johnson Amendment? Because we're dealing with that now. We're talking about the IRS, you know, the threatening the church status. Should we just get rid of this Johnson Amendment, the law that says religious and nonprofit organizations can't say anything about candidates or individuals? Should churches be able to say, hey, well, look, this is an important issue. You should be looking at this candidate.
See, the problem is that the Johnson Amendment isn't the problem. That's a symptom of the problem. But the idea that the tax code is to be used to regulate political speech, that's where the action is. You know, and like I said, political parties are tax exempt.
Yep.
So the idea that you can't say anything for or against a candidate is right. Just not true.
Right.
But more importantly, the C3 status is the one where you get tax deductibility. You know, so it would not really hit the church. You still wouldn't, you know, you wouldn't necessarily, well, it would in some ways, but primarily they're going to be going after the donors, not the church itself.
Yeah, no, I gotcha. That makes sense. You know, outside of the IRS coming after the church and really the vote, religious liberty. You know, I said this when I was watching Obergefell and marriage being redefined. Yeah, I knew we'd see bad fruit from of course, Roe v. Wade, and we've seen that. And the same thing is now happening from us for the Supreme Court erroring and making a terrible decision when it came to marriage in this country. And I've said when that decision went down, I think it was 2015, I said, you know what? The next thing in the crosshairs, something we need to pray for and really be vigilant about, is religious liberty in this country. How do you see it? I mean, where are we right now? Are we on the slippery slope? Or are we in that pot that's slowly getting turned up and the water's getting hotter and people aren't realizing it? How in danger is religious liberty in our country today? And of course, you know, we remember, you know, the Catholic bishops today have, you know, this is the week that they normally had the fortnight, you know, leading up to the fourth, but the Catholics are encouraged to pray this week on behalf of religious freedom. That's what our nation's bishops are calling. I'd love your assessment of where we are and what you see looming in the not too distant future.
Well, you know, yes, it's getting worse. It's definitely getting worse. The government's getting more bold about it. You know, before they would kind of hide behind niceties, you know, but the basic idea is they don't want any dissent. And the idea that you might embarrass a politician is exactly, you know, what the IRS is not supposed to be doing. That's not their job. You know, but remember, you've got a lot of federal agencies out of control right now.
Yeah.
And they're trying to ruthlessly enforce a political agenda.
That is so true. Well, my guest today, Professor Robert Destro, has said if you want to join us, 888-914-9149. And We're glad to take a few more of your calls. I'm going to take a short pause. When we come back, I only have the professor for a few moments, so feel free to dial in. It's about 15 minutes before the top of the hour. We're back with more right after this. Catholic Order of Foresters is proud to sponsor the relevant radio studio line. For information about employment opportunities and flexible premium life insurance plans, visit relevantradio.com/Forester.
The Drew Mariani Show, live
at 888-914-9149.
The Drew Mariani Show on Relevant Radio.
Good to be here with you today. Thank you for joining me. We'll pray the chaplet in about 10 minutes, so feel free to dial in and join us. If you're just getting plugged in, I'm speaking today with Professor Robert Destro, a professor of law at Columbus School of Law, the Catholic University of America, and of course a great defender of religious liberty. We're taking a look at what's happening in the culture at large. I was sharing a little bit about the communion issue that came up during the break. The professor and I were both talking about, you know, I did a show yesterday on critical race theory. We've been talking a lot about that. And even the FBI surveillance. Professor, what else are you seeing? Maybe you can highlight those points. We started with communion here, but, you know, CRT is one that really is concerning a lot of parents. You know, the targeting of families and the indoctrination of children, even FBI surveillance. Fill us in.
Well, you know, the problem is when the government decides that it's going to start to exactly what it does. It starts to treat members of the community as if they're enemies, and it starts to surveil them. That's what the FBI is doing.
Right.
It treats you like you're not a member of the community. That's what they're doing with the critical race theory. The Department of Education is spending hundreds of billions of dollars on all of that, and they're demonizing, you know, I mean, anybody who's had to sit through the implicit bias training knows that basically, you know, they've turned Martin Luther King's idea that you're judged by the content of your character on its head.
Yeah, that's so true. All right, let's grab a quick call, and I know you got to run. We'll get Michelle in Illinois. She's got a question for you. Michelle, good afternoon.
Well, I understand. I'm probably on a different political bent than you are. But I'm not for abortion, but I am for, you know, a woman being able to choose for herself. Because I can remember being a little girl and I'm 72, and I can remember when I was a little girl, my parents whispering, talking about women being found in an alley, and both the baby and the mother was dead. Mm-hmm. And also, it seems like one political party that wants choice, then the other political party is for capital punishment. So how do you choose?
All right, great, great question. So, Professor, let's break that down for her. You know, a lot of people will say, well, you say you're pro-life, but, you know, what about immigration? What about the death penalty? But what about some of these other issues? And sometimes the parties, they cross lines on those particular issues. Now, Michelle's about a woman's right to choose. I'm about a woman's right to choose, but I'm not about a woman's right to terminate an innocent life in her child, you know, her child in her womb. But let's address that. I'll let you take on Michelle on that, and I'll follow up on you.
Well, I mean, if our topic is whether the IRS has any business, you know, playing with people's tax exemptions, well, there are, you know, organizations that are in favor of, you know, pro-abortion, the right to choose, And there are, you know, tax-exempt organizations that are pro-life. You know, the job of the government is to treat all of us equally and not to discriminate among us based on our point of view. That's what democracy is all about. And so, you know, I'm not sure, you know, exactly why, you know, the there's a big diversity in the Catholic community. That's part of what the teaching function of the church is all about.
Yeah, and back to Michelle's point just on the whole life issue. There's this blurred line between a person saying, hey, this woman has a right to choose versus the child in the womb. And I think we have a real problem in our culture, Professor. I think we need to rehumanize the child in the womb, and yet there's a great blindness to it. Nancy Pelosi was asked the other day, is a 15-year-old child is a 15-year-old baby in the womb a human life? Somebody at a press conference asked Jen Psaki the same thing. Jake, do you have the audio? Let me play this for you. This is Nancy Pelosi. Listen to what she said.
Let me just say that I'm a big supporter of Roe v. Wade. I am a mother of 5 children in 6 years. I think I have some standing on this issue as to respecting a woman's right to choose.
So that was her response to the question, is this a baby in the womb? How do you address that? I mean, the politicians totally step aside these direct questions about when life begins. And I think too many people bought into it, as if though a woman's right to choose overcomes the right to live.
Well, see, you know, most of the people, you know, and I don't think I'm speaking out of turn when I say that, they say that's not the issue. You know, the Supreme Court, even in Roe versus Wade, basically said when life begins is completely irrelevant. It's a question of whether or not the state, you know, can stop a woman from deciding to terminate a pregnancy. And that's really the pro-life side, is talking about humanizing the baby. You know, a lot of people, the really consistent people on the pro-choice side, say it really doesn't make any difference because this is a question of whether or not the woman has the right to choose. I mean, I think that's a fair statement of what the issue is.
Right. All right. Let me just take a call in from Brian because we're running out of time here. Brian, thanks for joining us. You're on the air with Professor Destro.
Yes, thank you for taking my call. I just wanted to say that I'm an atheist, and I dial in every once in a while, and I like to hear the discourse. And this is the first time I've dialed in for several months, and I'm hearing a lot more conversation about politics than I ever have before. Usually I dial in to listen to what the Christian or whatever religious stations are saying, as to how they're conducting themselves. And I've realized that there's more conversations about politics than ever before in my personal experience. So I wanted to originally talk about the separation of church and state, and how your tax-exempt status has to do with how you're not supposed to be in politics. But that has clearly, evidently gone out the window. So from there, I would like to have a discussion.
Great. All right, Professor, why don't you bring it back to Thomas Jefferson's letter to the Danbury Baptist on the wall of separation of church and state?
Well, you know, the whole idea of separation of church and state has never been about churches not being involved in politics. That's a much more recent, I mean, back in the New England days, the town meetings were held inside the churches. You know, even in Thomas Jefferson's day, Richmond paid for a Sunday school. So the idea that somehow separation of church and state is to protect the state against, you know, commentary by the church, I'm not sure where that came from, but it's clearly not consistent with history or the law.
May I please interject?
Sure, Brian.
Sure, please.
The tax exempt status awarded to the church, not just the Catholic, but all churches and synagogues and temples across the country were clearly defined as not having influence over our politics. Now, I admit, I totally grant you the fact that in the history of the country,
churches have been an integral part of not just the basic founding of town, but it's been something that is clearly representative of the electorate. I grant you that. However, there has been a shift recently about the influence that the church has been having on our body politic, especially in the Trump era. Right. And I don't, and please let me finish. I'm not a Democrat necessarily, but I see a one-sided argument coming from this station attacking, right, clearly attacking the right Democratic side.
But Brian, I'm going to hold you on that because I've got about 40 seconds and I want to give the professor the last thought. You heard his comments, Professor. I'll let you wrap it up. All right. I think I just accidentally lost the professor there. Brian, I'll address your issue. Politics, the reason we talk about it, it's a mechanism for change in this country. And there are moral issues that underpin that. I know you don't believe in God. If you completely separate God from our nation as Freedom from Religion Foundation, which you might be familiar with, you end up with a government that begins to believe that the rights that we have been granted to us by the government and not by a supreme creators, our founding fathers believe. So if God gives those rights, no human person can take them from us. I'll be back. We'll pray the chaplet right after this.